Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
You know, when I was a kid, when I was 7, 8 years old, a radio was only in its infancy, and all the big stars were on radio, you know, Bob Hope and Burns and Allen, and I used to sit there and just, with my hands like this, staring into the, and listening to everything. My mother couldn't pull me away from the radio. I listened to soap operas, I listened to news, I listened to all the announcers, I just absorbed all this. I was just completely enthralled with this box that talked.
That was longtime L.A. radio DJ Art LeBeau speaking to KTTV about his lifelong love of the medium. His show was just canceled after 23 years, and his fans are not having it. We'll find out what made the 89-year-old Art LeBeau such an icon. But first, there is a crisis at the nation's West Coast ports. Shipping companies are suspending the unloading of cargo ships for 4 days. Half of all the shipping containers carrying cargo entering and leaving the U.S. come through West Coast ports, including those here at L.A. and Long Beach. But an ongoing dispute between longshoremen and the shipping companies is causing the slowdown. And that means huge ships are just sitting offshore waiting to unload their containers filled mainly with products from Asia. And conversely, California goods that are supposed to be exported are just languishing on the docks. Joining me to explain what's going on is Karen Robis Meeks. She covers trade and transportation for the Long Beach Press-Telegram. Welcome, Karen.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, it seems like a pretty extreme move that the shipping companies are suspending the unloading of cargo ships for 4 days. I mean, these are the busiest ports in the nation, and so much cargo goes in and out of them. Why did they say that they're going to do this?
Well, they feel that the union is causing these slowdowns that would not allow them to move cargo in and out of yards. And they feel like, why should we pay dock workers premium pay, meaning overtime for holiday and weekend pay, for 50% of the work that they're doing?
Oh, because this is a holiday weekend. Today is considered a holiday, Lincoln's birthday, and Monday is President's Day, and so they would get extra wages?
Yes.
So they're saying, well, because longshoremen, you have slowed down work over the previous weeks, we're not going to reward you with these bonuses?
Yes.
And then what's the response by the longshoremen's union?
Right. Well, the dock workers union are vehemently denying that they are the cause of the slowdowns. They are saying that for months, employers have been cutting back on those shifts. They said sometimes a typical work shift would require 1,200 jobs, and over the last few months, they have seen a reduction in the number of shifts that the employers are asking for. And so they feel like it's the employers who are creating the slowdowns, not the union.
And so the backdrop behind all of this is a long simmering dispute over contracts and the two sides fighting over a new contract that seems to have been going on for months.
Yes. You know, when we started reporting this back in May, they were very positive that things would be resolved before the end of July. The president of the employers group said that, you know, we may not come to an agreement on June 30th, which was when the contract expired, but that they were really sure that they were going to have something done by the end of July. Obviously, that hasn't happened. And the reason for that is because there seems to be sticking points on certain issues. First, it was the issue of chassis, which is the trailers needed to tow cargo containers in and out of the port. Now it seems to be this issue with arbitration. The employers group is saying that the union wants the right to fire an arbitrator if that arbitrator doesn't side with the union. Now, the union has said, no, you are totally mischaracterizing what we want out of this contract. So that's the issue right now.
Okay, so it has devolved to this point where they're actually stopping pretty much all the unloading happening at the ports. So what does that mean for the companies that need to get their their products in and out of the United States. Are they going to go elsewhere to other ports?
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. So there has been a ripple effect throughout the supply chain. I mean, we are looking at least a dozen ships every day stranded at the ports of LA and Long Beach waiting for a place to unload their goods. We're seeing long truck lines, truckers waiting up to 5-6 hours for a container that they might not get. We're also seeing weeks-long shipment delays. So I'm getting calls from people in the Philippines, people in France, people in New York, wondering where their furniture is, where their goods are. Now we're also looking at exporters and importers, people who rely on these goods to be delivered at a certain time. I know of several toy companies, Apple exports, clothing people who are deciding to completely bypass the West Coast and either shipping through the Gulf Coast, the East Coast, ports in Canada and Mexico, or they're shelling out the extra cost by shipping everything by air just so they can get their goods on time.
Wow. So that really does sound like a huge mess financially. So is that going to pressure the two sides to come to a deal anytime soon? Because maybe this could be permanent, that these companies feel like, well, we're not going to risk it again to go through the West Coast ports.
I mean, both sides feel the pressure that they need to get something done. And they are aware that these slowdowns are causing businesses to leave the ports of LA and Long Beach. But at the same time, they're both blaming each other for causing this whole thing to happen. So we'll just have to wait and see how things pan out.
Well, is there any other body that can come in, the NLRB or someone like that, who could come in and say, let's force you two to the bargaining table and let's hammer out an agreement?
You know, there is the involvement of a federal mediator, and that was requested on behalf of both parties. And so that person has been coming in. There's a lot of political pressure for the White House to intervene on this, but we haven't heard as to whether or not they'll do that. We'll just have to wait and see.
And meanwhile, can you put a financial figure on what this is costing the ports?
Right. So the National Retail Federation put out this study that said about $1 billion a day are being lost.
$1 billion a day?
Yes.
Wow. Karen Robus-Meeks covers trade and transportation for the Long Beach Press-Telegram. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
$1 billion a day, and one industry feeling the brunt, California's citrus growers. That's a $2.4 billion a year business. While the most perishable fruits and vegetables are flown out, usually oranges are still largely shipped out. So they're really feeling the pain of this. Tom Wallerman is a third generation citrus grower and manager of Labu Citrus in Lindsay, California. Hi there.
Yes.
How bad is this for you?
Well, it's real bad, and it's setting up to become even worse here. We're a fairly large size independent citrus packing house here in Central California. Normally, from this time on, many times 50% of the product that we harvest and pack here, we ship to Asia. Normally, earlier in the season, it's not quite that amount, but right now we should be shipping probably 50, 60, 70 loads, container loads of citrus to either Korea, Japan, or Australia. And we're lucky if we're shipping half that amount or even less than that. So it's a very, very big deal for us here in Lindsay, California.
So where are your oranges now?
Well, our oranges are in our groves and we're harvesting them and we're shipping some domestically. And in the meantime, we are filling up some containers and shipping them to the ports either in the Bay Area or Southern California. And then therein lies our problem. We put our containers down there, and then from a day-to-day basis, it's really hard for us to get information about what time they're going to be loaded or what time the vessel's going to come in. And it's a real nightmare for us.
So are they just sitting there on the docks,
you know,
rotting?
They're sitting there. They're in containers, and they have their refrigeration units. But, you know, citrus is a perishable commodity, so it can sit in a container for, you know, a couple weeks, and then it'll eventually start to erode a little bit. But the problem is that there's what normally is a 2-week vessel ride to Asia, is now, because of certain things and slowness of the vessels, a three-week vessel ride. And then if you have your citrus sitting on the dock for 2 weeks, the problem is when you get to Korea or Japan and you open the doors on that container, that's when you find your real mess. So that creates huge problems for us as the shippers and for the receivers on that side. So what we're forced to do from time to time, if we have containers down at the dock, if they've been down there for more than a week or so, we have to bring those back up, offload that fruit, and find another home for that fruit. And it's very, very, very costly and very cumbersome for us.
So how much have you lost so far because of this?
Well, in terms of dollar amount, we're probably down 150, 175 container loads. Each container is worth maybe, let's say, $15,000 or $20,000. So that's the amount of revenues we've lost at this point in fruit that we cannot ship to that market. Now, we can ship that fruit sometimes to a lesser valuable market, but still, that is product that we haven't shipped over there, and those are the dollar amounts that we have not received back for that product.
So you and your colleagues must be pretty frustrated with what's happening at the
port. We're really frustrated because we're not really taking sides on whether it's the labor fault or the Pacific Maritime Association's fault. We feel that there's culpability on both parts. The tragedy is we and the American public is being held hostage to this. And this is not a strike, it's a slowdown. If it were a strike, the federal government could order the folks back to work. But by design, it is a slowdown to where they're only working at about 20% capacity. This weekend, they're taking off several theoretical holidays and stuff like that. So, yeah, we're really being victimized by this, all the citrus people and all of the other ag commodities that use vessels to ship to Asia.
So we heard in the previous segment that some companies are thinking of going to other ports. Is that something that you've considered, or is something that's not possible for you?
Well, there's not, realistically, we can't go to other ports. We have, in a limited amount, we might be able to use a different type of vessel that's more of a freighter type, where the fruit goes into the hold of the ship versus being placed in the containers. But that is not a solution for us. And you know, your main ports are in Southern California, the Bay Area, and maybe out of Seattle and then Vancouver. Those are your major West Coast points. The only other option you would have is theoretically you could go through Texas, but then the fruit would have to go through the canal and stuff like that, and then you incur the cost of shipping it to Texas, and that's not really economically viable for us.
What about flying it out?
Well, you know, you can do that, and we do from time to time air freight certain very, very high-value citrus products. But for navel oranges, let's say, that's more of a commodity, although they're quite pricey, the air freight on that is really cost prohibitive. You know, one container load of fruit is 40,000 pounds. So to air freight 40,000 pounds, that's very expensive.
Yeah, it's not like shipping kale.
No, it's not like shipping little truffles or something like that, where, you know, one pallet or 1,000 pounds goes a long way. Citrus is a very bulky item.
Okay, so this dispute between the two sides has been going on for a long time. It seems to be just getting worse, but it has been drawn out for the better part of a year. What do you think is going to happen, and what can you do?
Well, I think at this particular point, you know, eventually everything is resolved. I think public opinion is going to start to amount to such an extent that there's going to be increased amount of pressure placed on this. And ultimately, the spinoff on this, it'll affect the stock market. This is such a huge deal when you affect commerce from the West Coast to Asia. It is not just us shipping product to Asia. In China, the manufacturers of every kind of widget in the world, they're kind of hung up shipping stuff over to here. So there's a lot of really ticked off people over on the other side of the Pacific pond, so to speak, that are getting harmed from this. No one is going to forget about this when they get it resolved. And I would assume that at some point down the road, there'll be some sort of political, legislative action may be designed to curtail this in the future. I cannot see how Congress, Senate, the American public would allow this to happen at a future date.
Tom Wellman, manager of Labou Citrus in Lindsay, California. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up, the dark side of being connected, your Fitbit talking to your HMO, how to slow down the Internet of Things, and what happens when you let yourself be bored. Those stories next on Press Play.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're getting ever closer to the day when our cars, our appliances, and even our own bodies are plugged into the internet at all times. The idea is called the Internet of Things. It means, for example, our refrigerator can warn us when we're almost out of milk. Our washing machines can order more laundry soap directly from Amazon. It also means our cars can tell our insurance companies exactly how fast we drive. And that Fitbit around your wrist, well, it can send your health information directly to your health insurance company. This could all make our lives easier, but also scarier in the age of hackers, data breaches, and direct marketing. And that's why the government is starting to pay attention. Manoush Zomorodi is host of WNYC's New Tech City, and she's here to talk about that and other web-related news. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, released a report recently looking at the concerns associated with this Internet of Things. And how far does this report go into easing our privacy concerns?
Well, you know, maybe not that far, Madeline. The FTC doesn't call for a specific law, but it kind of invites Congress to pass broader legislation that could potentially protect consumers. And it makes sort of recommendations for best practices for companies, what they're calling data minimization. And so, you know, they're saying to companies, keep as little data as you possibly can. Dump the data when you don't need it anymore. Strip out identifiable information from any data when you can. Sort of things that we would hope companies would be doing anyway without prodding from the FTC, but I think they want to just be on the record that they are putting it down in paper, so to speak.
But what's going to force a company to do that? It's not necessarily in their financial interest to do so.
No, it's absolutely not. As you said, these companies are going to be getting more and more data from your GPS, from your fitness tracker, from our smart appliances. And this data could say a lot about your health, your financial stability, your personal life, and maybe things you don't necessarily want to share with your employer or your insurance provider or anyone for that matter. And that is why I think that the FTC can't say specifically what the law should be because technology is changing so quickly, but they do want to sort of have basic guidelines in place. But a lot of people are saying, no, this does not go far enough, not yet, not when there are already over 25 billion connected devices in use around the world.
Right. And then if you opt out of this, then maybe people might think you have something to hide.
Yeah, absolutely. They'll think you have something to hide, or maybe you're not a good customer because you don't want to show that actually you're not walking 3 miles a day like you say you are. But, you know, the worry is it's not just about how it could be used against you in terms of profiling in some way. It's, of course, also hackers, you know, that there are other people who want to steal this data that even if you do want the company to have it, you don't want anybody else to have it. And as we know, our data is not being as protected as thoroughly as it ought to be.
Okay, moving on to something else. Over at your show, New Tech City, you've been running this experiment called Bored and Brilliant. And the idea being that people can be more creative if they stop looking at their smartphones all the time to, you know, ease their boredom and to be bored for a while and let their minds wander. And so your staff and some listeners tried doing this, tried putting the phone down.
Yeah.
It's so scary just saying that. How did it go?
I can hear. It was pretty good. So there were over 18,000 people signed up to do a week of challenges where the very first day, they tried to keep their phone in their pocket instead of walking down the street and looking at it like so many of us here in New York do. Or if they were riding in the carpool or if they were waiting for the train, to just not look at their phone. That was the first day. And as we went on through the week, we had more sort of creative assignments. for people to do. All in all, the data has now come in. Speaking of data, we didn't cut down a ton of time, about 6 minutes total. But what was interesting is that about 90% of those we surveyed afterwards said that they felt very confident that they could change the way that they use their phone in the future, and that this was something that they wanted to continue to think about using their technology more purposefully rather than reflexively, which I think it has become for a lot of us.
Yeah. And so who are the worst offenders?
The gamers are pretty bad. The gamers cut down the most time on their phones. They cut down about 20 minutes a day from the average. We started out collectively at spending about 2 hours a day on our phones. The other people who had a good effect were parents, actually. They cut down an average of 10 minutes a day, so we don't know exactly why. Guilt is my guess, has something to do with it. I think we got a lot of really personal stories from people saying, you know, I am so aware that my kids watch my behavior and that I don't want them to think that me being beholden to this slab of technology on the kitchen counter is good or okay. And I'm tired of constantly not being in one place. I want to either be at work or be with my kids. I wonder, Madeline, if there's some sort of backlash to this integrated life that we've created for ourselves, where we can be with our families and work too. And I used to think that was a great thing. And now I'm sort of thinking I'm not doing either one very well, and maybe it would be better to just concentrate on one or the other.
But I think there's also an addiction part of it, too, that people reach reflexively to get that hit of adrenaline or hit of, I don't know, serotonin
Dopamine.
No,
that's exactly
what it is,
right.
That they, when they get a message or they get an email, it's a brief burst of happiness. Brief being the operative word, because then you read it and you're like, oh. But, you know, that it's hard to break that habit because it is actually a physical brain addiction.
That's exactly right. And what we wanted people to do instead was to get their brain into something that's called the default mode. This is when you are not being stimulated, when you're physically not active. But when you're in the default mode, when you get bored, that's when your brain trips into mind wandering. And that, as neuroscientists told us, is when we do our most creative thinking. We do our problem solving. And we also do something called autobiographical planning. And this is looking back at our lives and deciding moments that really meant something to us that maybe we want to repeat. We set goals. We strategize how to get to those places. And if we're always looking at our phone, we can't do a lot of that, unfortunately. I think this is something that is going to, a lot of us are starting to feel uneasy with our phones. We don't quite know why. And so with our Bored and Brilliant project, I think we sort of scratch the surface of what some of the longer term effects could be of smartphones on our attention, on our thinking.
Okay, last topic, and we just can't skip it. Thanks to the wonder of the internet, the Spice Girls are
Oh, I'm so glad we got to this one, Madeline. I was worried that we wouldn't have time. I can give you what you want.
So that's one of four unreleased Spice Girls tracks, and these aren't new tracks. They're not getting back together, unfortunately. So tell us about them, Manoush.
So four tracks that were recorded for the 2000 album Forever. They're called Pain Proof, Right Back At Ya, A Day in Your Life, and If It's Lovin' on Your Mind, which I think is what we were listening to. I don't know. All Spice is good Spice as far as I'm concerned. Any excuse to listen to them, I will take it. And I just kind of want to know, which Spice are you, Madeline?
Oh, that's easy. Scary. Scary Spice. At least that's what my husband says.
Then you're doing something right. Girl power.
And you?
You know, I think I want to be Ginger, even though I physically don't qualify.
Because Ginger is spicy.
Redheaded.
Gingers are spicy.
Totally.
Right. Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's New Tech City. Thanks, Manoush. Or Ginger.
Thanks, Madeline. Thank you.
Coming up, the Princess Kaguya versus Big Hero 6, the yin and yang of the Oscar nominees for Best Animated Feature. We'll look at all the nominees after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What most people know about the Oscar race for Best Animated Feature is that the Lego movie never made it to the starting line, but the mourning period is done. Teeth have been gnashed, garments rended. No, it's time to talk about movies that did get the nod. This is a positive segment, including some foreign stunners and a big-budget sequel that may have surpassed the original. Our guides today are William Bibbiani, film editor for Crave Online. Welcome.
Hello.
And Whitney Seibold, contributor to Crave Online. Together,
we are Wild Stallions.
Together, you host the B-Movies podcast.
That's right.
And you.
Let's start our animation tour today with the tale of Princess Kaguya. It's from Studio Ghibli, and here's a clip from the trailer.
I have heard the rumors about her.
Oh my.
If disobedience to His Majesty is considered a crime punishable by death, well then, the only choice is to kill me.
All right, this is from Studio Ghibli, as I mentioned, but not made by Hayao Miyazaki.
Yes, so it's made by Isao Takahata, who is just as good as Hayao Miyazaki, I would say. He's been working with Studio Ghibli for many years. He did some of their bigger classics, like Grave of the Fireflies and My Neighbors, the Yamadas. He works a little bit out of the box compared to Hayao Miyazaki. He renders a lot of his works in, like in the Tale of the Princess Kaguya, in sort of this pencil and watercolor palette. Everything looks very gentle. It looks like a storybook. And he also deals much more gently and much more placidly than even Hayao Miyazaki.
That trailer clip made this movie sound really tense and exciting. And it's, and don't get me wrong,
this is not a thriller. This is a fable.
Yeah.
And it's based on a Japanese folktale. And it feels very kind of illogical, but very dream logic in that storybook sort of way.
Yeah, it kind of snuck into town and didn't get a lot of press, a lot of promotion.
Yeah.
So probably a lot of people haven't seen it. Can you give us a quick plot outline?
The Tale of Princess Kaguya is about a poor old elderly couple, and they find a child basically growing inside a flower, and then the child keeps growing up very, very quickly. And they decide to devote all of their time to giving this child the life they think it deserves and letting it be a princess.
That of a princess.
Yes, but it turns out that the child isn't necessarily suited to being a princess, and that the many sort of ridiculous foibles and rules of aristocratic life in Japan are not going to make her happy, and it ends up going on from there. That's really what it is. It's a story of a girl in an unusual situation, sure, but coming of age, becoming confident and powerful in her own way, denying suitors in ways that are just delightful. But it's beautifully animated, and it's very character-driven and sweet, and I think the ending is really not going to be what people expect.
Yeah.
Not in like some weird twist-a-roo
way. It's not princess ending.
No, it's not. Well, it's not even, it's barely a princess movie, really.
Yeah.
Usually when like a girl who's poor becomes a princess in a movie, it becomes the Princess Diaries, and there's a lot of montages of putting on clothes, and there's a place for that, but this is not that movie.
But they want to be a princess, and that's where this one twists. This is a really tough sell because it's so gentle. There's not going to be some sort of big fight in this movie. Even in something like Frozen, there's going to be some gigantic climax, which is unneeded. I prefer movies to be a little bit more placid and to move organically the way this one does. It's long. It's 2 hours and 17 minutes. But it needs all of that time to sort of breathe and have those incidental moments that really bring the film to life.
Okay, that's The Tale of Princess Kaguya, another foreign animated film, Song of the Sea, also gentle and also hand-drawn. This is by the same people who did Secret of Kells, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Tom Moore is the director.
Tom Moore.
Name.
He co-directed Secret of Kells, and he directed this one himself.
So an Irish movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a little girl who finds herself at the center of a myth come to life. Her brother fights to save her. And here's a clip.
She's not safe in this awful place.
Ugh, Granny. She's going to try and make us move to the city again.
At last, we found her.
Saoirse!
Run!
Those stories that Mum told me, they're all true. Are you really a Selkie?
What is a Silkie?
A Selkie is an old Celtic myth about people who could turn into seals. Like a seal
in
the ocean. It's
an Irish were-seal, essentially.
Basically, oh. Yeah. But stories of Selkies are often stories of sadness and loss. And this is what Song of the Sea is really about. It is gorgeously animated. It's very imaginative and inventive. And in fact, it's my favorite animated film from last year. But what it is about is it's about a family. The mother had died, seemingly giving birth to the youngest daughter. And the family is just withering away with grief. And the children are sent away to live with their grandmother, who wants them to get over it. But the child is a Selkie, and the brother has to go off and try to rescue her before the family endures even more loss. But it is gorgeously animated. It is wonderfully inventive. And it's a real treat, honestly. I think it deals with very mature issues in a way that I think children can understand, and I think a way will be very helpful to children, I think.
It deals with mourning and loss, which is something you don't see in a lot of kid movies. I also really love the animation style. It's very broad and comic in a lot of ways. Everything's very abstract in the actual animation style. It feels and looks a lot like The Princess Gagulia. It feels like a fable. This one feels a lot more like a bedtime story in a lot of ways. It feels like a lullaby. There's
both
a lot of
these
song
movies
and music
are
going
so,
on.
They're so different from the American animated movies.
Well,
it's hard to even imagine them in the same category.
They're not like a $100 million project that needs a lot of product placement to get by, that needs to appeal to everyone. There's a lot of freedom in other countries to make an animated film is more distinctive.
When Disney takes on the fairy tale stuff, it turns into something very rambunctious and very energetic.
And that can be great, to be clear.
It can be great, but they tend to reinterpret things into something very similar. All of their movies do move very similarly. It's nice to have sort of the fable and the myth move in the way I think they were originally intended to in the hands of these foreign directors.
Well, speaking of, Disney's Big Hero 6 is also nominated. And what did you guys think of that one?
I like this one a lot. Whitney, I think, wasn't as big a fan.
Not so much.
Yeah, I thought this was a nice... I mean, in many ways, it's a very conventional superhero tale, but I thought it was done with a lot of character. I thought it was done with a lot of humor. And it also deals with loss in a way that, for an American movie in particular, I thought was... quite nice. And yeah, it ends up being reduced to a big superhero fight at the end, but that's what you expect from the genre.
And this is in the front, I mean, you know, for what it's worth, the front runner.
Well, I think
status.
It's just because it's the one the most people have seen. It's the one most Academy voters will vote for because they know it.
I think that
beyond the mascot robot of Baymax, who is actually a rather fun and brilliant creation, a caring inflatable balloon man, essentially, who kind of carries the movie, there's not a whole lot going on in this of much interest. And I feel that the message is a little mixed. It's supposed to be vaunting the intellectual kids who are building things and how you should use your intellect. And that's nice. Use your smarts, kids. But they use their smarts to build instruments of violence, and that's kind of a mixed message.
I think you're being a little reductive, but I think that's what it turns out. They use the science they were using for nonviolent methods to actually help the world.
Into violent
they
methods.
End up having to turn to violence because it's a superhero story. I mean, if you're not going to accept that, it's like I would like this comedy a lot more if it didn't have any jokes in it. Like, you're basically denying it its own genre. I disagree with that take on it.
If that's the case, then the genre is not very interesting.
Then that's fine. You're entitled to that opinion. I mean, I like this movie more than... I'm not sure it's the front runner, though. I wouldn't be surprised if it won. It's obviously very popular. And Baymax is really an ingenious creation, I think.
Okay, let's move on to The Box Trolls. That's by the same animation house that made Coraline and Paranorman. Here's a clip.
Who are you, boy?
I'm a box troll.
Then let's see you fit in your box.
Please help us.
You need to look like a proper boy.
Supercarical.
Yes. Yes! No.
So this is the only stop motion animated movie. It is funny from the trailer. I didn't see the movie. Did you like it,
Whitney? I kind of adore it in a way because it is an ugly and filthy movie in a way that you don't usually see.
In an intentional way.
It feels very lived in.
It feels like a, you know, living in the streets with Dickens urchins. Even the sky looks greasy and filthy. And that level of grit is something you don't usually see in most movies, in fact.
And especially like a family movie where you want everything to be very appealing and you want to sell a lot of merchandise. So it's very distinctive.
The main characters are these box trolls. They live in the sewers of this unusual British town, and they're being exterminated over the course of the years, a human boy is being raised amongst them, thinking he is a troll. The trolls eat bugs. They are unattractive to look at. The boy is really dirty, and the main girl that he meets up with is not a prim little princess, but she's very enthusiastic about violence and gore.
I love that girl. I think she's one of the better family movie creations in a while. She is so... She's smart, but she's sensitive and she just wants love. But at the same time, she's obsessed with morbidity. When she gets when she falls into the box, it's like, no, don't put me in the pile of skulls. Where is the pile of skulls? I thought there'd be a pile of skulls, and I'm very disappointed.
And then the villain who wants to become part of the elite so he can eat fancy cheeses, only he is allergic to cheese.
And we get to some very grotesque moments,
he
actually.
He eats cheese and breaks out into these big, disgusting pustules. Pustules are... Yeah.
How many times can you say pustules in the same breath?
I like that you're actually using that word.
It's
evocative.
It's very apt.
It's onomatopoeia.
Box Trolls is a movie that the critical community didn't really rally behind. I think everyone appreciated the craftsmanship behind it. It is certainly an impressive achievement. But a lot of people just found the story not terribly interesting. I find it pleasingly weird. I think it's a very enjoyable film that I think people are going to rally around in time. But I think we were expecting something a little bit more polished like their previous works. Paranorman and Coraline.
It's a movie for weird little kids, and we need more of those.
We need more weird little kids, we need more movies for them.
I was just going to say, more weird little kids, yes. Okay, the last movie to make the list, How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Can I know you?
No.
You were only a babe, but a mother never forgets.
Unbelievable. You've been rescuing them.
Something is coming. Something you've never faced before.
The dragons are among now. Protect our people. It's your destiny.
Obviously, from the title, this is a sequel.
Yes.
Does it match up to the original?
Arguably, yes. I think it, obviously, it's a sequel. It depends on the original for its existence, but I think this one, in many ways, is a better crafted movie. I think it's a more exciting movie from an adventure perspective. Some people complain that it kind of undoes the message of the original film, which was more about independence, and this one's a little bit more about the subservience of dragons. And it doesn't really bother me. I just think it's a wonderfully animated, exciting adventure that gets to some very serious, dramatic places that I think kids are really going to respond to.
I like that the hero is actually a disabled boy. He is missing his foot, which he lost over the course of the first film. It's another film that sort of vaunts inventiveness and creativity and imagination overdoing violence. The entire message of the film is, let's not go to war.
Yeah, and then war is in some respects inevitable because there are jerks in the world, but what are you going to do? Yeah, this is the film that I think actually has the best chance of winning the Academy Award. I think it has a very classical, Academy-friendly adventure tone to it. I think if Lego Movie had been nominated, it would have won, but I think in its absence, I think this is the one to watch, and I think it's not my favorite, but I think it would be well-deserving.
So Song of the Sea was your favorite?
Absolutely my favorite.
William?
I think that movie is brilliant.
Whitney?
The Tale of the Princess Kaguya is my favorite.
Mine too. But it was the only
one
I saw of all of them.
By this cross-section, I guess that's the one that's going to win.
Of course.
Yeah.
We're definitely...
We all vote, right?
Yeah.
We represent the taste of the Academy, 100%.
Okay. William Bibbiani, Whitney Seibold with Crave Online, and together they also host the B-Movies podcast. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
Subscribe on iTunes.
Well, now I want to see all those movies. Did you see any of those movies, Warren?
No, I have not. I haven't had time. Too busy doing which way I land.
Okay, so what's up at 1 o'clock?
Well, today we're going to have a very interesting conversation about the president's request to Congress for powers to wage war against ISIS or ISIL, depending on what you choose to call it. We'll have lawyers debating the nature of the language in the resolutions that he's proposed, which is very interesting, actually. It's not as semantic as it sounds. And wait till you hear what General Scales has to say about those lawyers and the kind of argument that's going on in the Congress. He says that there's absolutely no point in all of this, that ISIL is going to win, that there's nothing we can do about it, that they're going to be there for a long, long time, and we better get used to it.
Well, so what happens if he doesn't get his approval from Congress?
Oh, he'll get the approval from Congress in one form or another, I would strongly suspect. We're also going to talk about the world's most successful sports gambler, a guy who's got a huge syndicate and has gone from a Kentucky childhood in poverty to a guy with six houses all over the world in a private plane. And
is this all
a
legal,
lot of people in Las Vegas
betting,
that don't
or?
Like him? Well, that's a good question.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll answer it in the next hour. To the point.
Indeed.
Thank you very much, Warren Olney. And coming up on this show, Art LeBeau. He's been a DJ on the LA airwaves for, what, more than 60 years? And now he's off the air thanks to a format change. More about the man who coined the term oldie but goodie next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
All right. We have a dedication now coming up here on the Art LeBeau Connection. And I'm told by my person answering the phone that I have Proxy on the phone. What are you going to play tonight, Proxy? Who are you going to send it out to?
Well, Art, I would
that's
like
DJ Art LeBeau, a fixture of LA radio for more than 60 years until this week. His show, The Art LeBeau Connection, has been taken off LA's airwaves as part of a programming overhaul. Hot 92.3, with its oldies format, is now Real 92.3, a hip-hop station. Well, fans are not happy. An online petition to get him back on the air already has more than 8,000 signatures. LeBeau was the first DJ to spin West Coast rock and roll. He invented the request and dedication and the term oldies but goodies. LeBeau himself isn't speaking publicly for now. He declined our interview request, but Harby Kubernick is here to tell us all about LeBeau's place in LA broadcasting history. He's a music journalist and author of several books. Welcome.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, he was on the air for about 60 years or more, and he's had the Art LeBeau connection for 23 years. What's his secret?
His secret is that, you know, he's a native Angeleno. It's a man who's about to turn age 90. He's a not just a fixture of L.A., he was nurtured by L.A., and he's, you know, a product of the L.A. public school system coming from downtown L.A., and radio has been his passion since he's 14 years old. And, I mean, to me, his departure from the airways is sort of like a regional audio amputation. I mean, he's the voice of Los Angeles, and he's not silenced. He'll reemerge, hopefully. But his secret is he had such a deep-rooted connection and loyal listenership, and he helped pioneer so many things in this town. I mean, introducing rock and roll radio, showing up at shopping centers, late-night shifts. I mean, one of his first early radio shifts in the late 40s and early 50s started at 3 a.m., and he was an advocate for rock and roll and breaking, in it, you know, the race music barrier and really connected the people to music, and then was a promoter putting on shows at El Monte Legion Stadium. And the biggest legacy he has, which is something nobody talks about, I mean, it's evident at your station where some of the radio personalities are music supervisors on movies and television shows. I mean, Art LeBeau had an open-door policy to the commoner. In the early 70s, George Lucas knocked on his door at Original Sound when he was just out of film school and starting in movies, and wanted some oldies but goodies for a movie he was developing called American Graffiti, which kind of birthed the soundtrack, the modern soundtrack album. And the fact that those songs ended up in American Graffiti, but Art LeBeau wasn't a corporate entity. He was a man of the people. And, you know, he pioneered the compilation album. There must be 40 volumes of that. And he just wasn't the voice of, you know, in connection to the Latino audience. He was a voice to the beach people and the valley people.
Right. Well, talk about the Latino connection, because he does have a strong Latino connection, and why is that?
Partly because he figured out very early, and we're going back to the mid and late 1950s, he started putting on dances and music shows in El Monte, which was a different zone, you know, a world than Los Angeles proper, different district. And in fact, there was even a slogan attached to the shows he put on, no Levi's jeans or capris, please. And little Willie G of the Midnighters told me when he went to some of those shows, you had to get a note from your school principal to attend those shows. And so he put on shows with Jerry Lee Lewis and Ricky Nelson and so many doo-wop acts that, when people were hating rock and roll and being threatened by rock and roll and making fun of it and calling it a nuisance, he had these multiracial acts put together long before people had even record deals or, you know, sold albums. It was an album. It was a world of the single and the 45 artists. Such active devotion that he pioneered the music for so many people.
Right. When Elvis came to town in 1956, the only interview he did was with Art LeBeau.
Absolutely, because Art had played his music even on Sun Records before Elvis even went over to the RCA label, and Colonel Parker made sure that they would meet, and he granted him an interview. And this is Elvis, you know, really around the appearance on the Dorsey Brothers Show or Ed Sullivan. And it's just to show the kind of relationship Art had with managers and artists and people coming to town. He, you know, there weren't very many people that were supporting this mutant form called rock and roll, and he was one of them. And he had an independent record label, and you know how popular everybody in your room has a record label now. So he did so many things. But the thing is, the thing about Art LeBeau that we're going to temporarily miss, hopefully, is that as a guy born in 1925, we should celebrate somebody who's 90 years old, who can do a daily air shift, who can still promote concerts at large venues, and look at him as an emeritus personality and a landmark voice. And I understand radio's a business, formats change. These things are part, of the journey. But there are some people that are like Mount Rushmore figures. Yeah. And I made it a point in the books I've done to just not quote him. I give him, devote whole chapters to him. And I'm so glad he's written his autobiography. And I'm actually stunned and sort of appreciative of the active petitions to have him on the air, because his shows were so strong and had that relationship to the Latino that I think this is a fact that I've read a couple places. His show was even streamed into prisons, so some of the inmates can hear dedications from some of their loved ones, in East L.A. and stuff like that. And that doesn't happen too often.
Well, yeah, and I guess what's fascinating also about this is, sure, he pushed boundaries back in the 50s and 60s, embracing this new modern rock form, but, he's known to most people now as someone who plays oldies, and yet he seems to be still popular with young people.
And here's the thing about oldies. I mean, this is the guy that all through the 70s, long before there was an LA Weekly, there used to be a Los Angeles Free Press, he had a weekly radio column discussing radio and championed, FM, the new FM rock stations that were happening. And as far as this oldies but goodies thing, what I find interesting, and it'll probably be revealed as I'm sort of, looking at this thing, is music that'll be played in the new format will either feature songs that he introduced or championed, or if we go into the hip-hop world and the new format that's being, instigated here, there's going to be a lot of songs on the playlist that include and integrate samples from songs that he introduced or pushed very hard over the decades. So his footprint is still quite obvious on even this new format that's being developed.
Well, he is not gone for good. He is on other radio stations, correct? And maybe he'll come back in Los Angeles.
Yes, but this is also part of a systematic trend I've noticed, where our disc jockeys and our people from Los Angeles who went to school here, like Dr. Domeno, you can't hear him in a regional L.A. market, but he's syndicated or on the Internet, or Art LeBeau has got syndication across the world in the United States, but you don't hear him in his hometown. And this is, a trend that I'm not going to sit shiva for Art LeBeau not having a radio gig, in his local. He's quite successful as a homeowner, selling his business and autobiography and owning the trademark Oldies But Goodies. However, I'd like to hear these people in my own hometown.
Harvey Kubernick, author of the book Turn Up the Radio, Rock, Pop, and Roll in Los Angeles, 1956 to 1972. Thanks for that, and thanks for remembering Art LeBeau with us.
And thank you very much, Madeline.
And here he is, Southern California's number one disc jockey, Art LeBeau.
Well, good evening. glad to have you here for our show. We have some great stars tonight. Let's get things underway with one of the currently popular songs of the day, Bobby Darin and Queen of the Hop. Here it is.
Oh, hello, Julie Myers.
I'm now going as Art LeJo.
You're too quick. You're not an oldie but a goodie. You're a newbie but a goodie.
I do enjoy the oldies but goodies. The joldies but goodies. Okay, so our listeners...
Okay, that's enough.
Our listeners are not just public radio fans. They're also fans of the oldies but goodies, too. Ryan Hopkins on Facebook says, no! What will happen to all the people who want to dedicate Angel Baby to their significant other in a California correctional facility? What are they supposed to do now? Jenny Messman wonders where she'll be able to hear oldies on the radio now. She is officially a sad girl. Martin Jude says that Art LeBeau really helped him connect with his parents. It's where he could hear all of the oldies that his parents loved growing up. They played all these oldies at family gatherings and celebrations for nostalgia reasons. He hopes that Art LeBeau can find a new home in Los Angeles, to which Jonathan Sykes replies, perhaps KCRW is looking to add oldies to its music lineup.
Okay. Do you hear that, Jennifer Farrow?
General Manager Jennifer Farrow. Sad girl.
Julie Myers, thank you very much.
Kisses. And
if you want to weigh in on Twitter, we're at KCRW Press Play, Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney, an oldie but a goodie, is up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.